Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to yet another press conference. You had a difficult day today, but I think this is the last one. So we have with us Ms. Francesca Albanese, Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967. Ms. Albanese was appointed by the Human Rights Council as independent expert in May of 2022. So we'll first ask her to tell us a little bit about her work and the report, and then there'll be time for questions. Ms. Albanese, over to you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. I just presented my fifth report, third to the General Assembly, which has a very harrowing title, Genocide as Colonial Erasure. And as I say in the first lines of the report, this is something that walks on the heels of my previous report, which I presented to the Human Rights Council in March this year, where I concluded that based on my findings over 5 months of investigation, there were reasonable grounds to believe that Israel had committed acts of genocide in Gaza. And I've continued to investigate what has happened in Gaza, but also the rest of the occupied Palestinian territory after presenting that report. I can say that for over 1 year, I've pleaded to all concerned parties, particularly those states who can exert more influence on the state of Israel, to take concrete actions to stop the destruction of Gaza, the destruction of the Palestinian people, to ensure the prompt and unconditional release of all hostages, both Israelis and Palestinians, and to ensure international law is respected. And had international law been respected, at least in the last 12 months, this would have stopped. It should have stopped. It should have been stopped by the Security Council last October. It should have been stopped after the first set of provisional measures issued by the International Court of Justice. It should have stopped when I presented my first report. It should have stopped before Rafah was invaded or before the invasion of Lebanon. And instead, the silence, or worse, the justification of a small but influential number of states has continued to enable and to nurture the hubris that leads Israeli conduct as we speak. The developments on the ground are gruesome, and since the beginning, the violence, the genocidal violence that I have described in my first report has expanded and metastasized in other parts of the occupied Palestinian territory. And if you look at the patterns of violence, the destruction of civilian infrastructure, roads, energy grids, water pipelines and reservoir homes, and if you look at the numbers of extrajudicial killings in the West Bank as well, on top of the 42,000 Palestinians who have been killed, ascertained killed in Gaza, including 17,000 children, how do you explain the over 700 Palestinians who have been killed in the West Bank, including 170 children? And how do we explain the fact that the Palestinians from the West Bank have been exposed to the same practices and abuses, often rape, among other forms of torture, than those in Gaza, if there was no Hamas military action or presence in the West Bank? Not that the first justified what Israel has done in Gaza. But again, not only we see the past reproducing itself in the occupied Palestinian territory, we see the same indifference, the same ability to look away of many member states in international community, and we see a total collapse of the international order, which is premised upon the never again that was promised after the Second World War, and in particular after the Holocaust and the genocide, mostly Jewish people. I'm very happy to take your questions. I don't know what else to say other than it's not been an easy year, because surely it has been reluctantly that I took on the functions of chronicler of a genocide, and it's extremely disturbing to see member states pontificating and questioning and obscuring the meaning of international law and dehumanizing the victims of this last 12 months. But however, should you have any questions, I'm here. Yeah, you do.
Okay. We have Abdelhamid.
Thank you so much. My name is Abdelhamid Sayam from the Arabic Daily Al-Quds Al-Arabi. Thank you for coming again to talk to us. I have a few questions. First, you have been personally attacked, as always the case when someone criticizes Israel, then they try to attack that person personally, like Graham Boole with UNRWA, Lazzarini, now Karim Khan, many others. So how do you take these personal attacks on you? And the second, as you know, international law allows people under occupation and foreign domination to resist. I mean, they become heroes. I mean, we have a statue of Mandela here, and because he was resisting apartheid. Many of the great leaders of modern time were at one stage fighting colonialism. Why only when the Palestinians fight occupation, they are labeled as terrorists? Thank you.
To be very clear, I don't think that Israel is the only state that attacks special rapporteurs. Special rapporteurs get attacked when they scrutinize the human rights records of member states. And there are states who are more vociferous and virulent than others. What is striking in the case of Israel is that there is a cohort of states who echoes and reverberates what Israel says and does, and there is an army of minions at work to produce literally fabrications that have one and only one objective: to distract the attention from where it should stay. So I will not entertain any discussion about how I take these attacks, because they're not just against me. They have been against the special rapporteurs on the occupied Palestinian territory who preceded me. And this year in particular, the Secretary General has been vilified and even declared persona non grata, welcome to the club. And so the General Assembly. What is more shocking to me is that this year, the United Nations have been under an unprecedented military attack. 70% of UNRWA premises have been hit by Israeli fire, and which has also hit peacekeepers in Lebanon. And the United Nations humanitarian functions have been hampered at the moment where they were the only bulwark to continue to provide assistance to the Palestinians in an extreme situation of distress. And it's because of that that I do believe that while Israel is by no means the only state that violates international law, and it's not even the only state that violates the right of self-determination of a people, but it's surely unique in the determination, the protractedness of this conduct and the fact that Israel has never faced any consequences. And indeed, I do believe that the impunity that has been granted to Israel has allowed it to become a serial violator of international law, which is the reason why I recommended that this is the time, as it has been for apartheid South Africa, to consider, for the General Assembly, to consider the suspension, I mean, recommending the revision or the suspension of Israel's credential as, credentials as a member of the United Nations until it ends violating international law, until it withdraws the occupation, which is clearly unlawful also by determination of the International Court of Justice, and surely until it continues its genocidal attack on the Palestinians.
You and then Mike.
Hi, my name is Ibtisam Azim, Al Arab Al Jadid newspaper. Good to see you again. I have two follow-ups. First, on the issue of suspension of Israeli membership or to the UN, if you could elaborate on that and whether you believe this is something that will get a majority in the General Assembly. And then My other question is regarding a third party's role in the war that's going on, whether it has to do with delivering weapons. I mean, their responsibility when it comes to international law and the lack of them taking any steps and basically supporting. So the accountability for not only for Israel, but also for third parties. And the last thing, in your remarks today to the committee, you talked about the lack of empathy that you are seeing by some member states in not even expressing any empathy for the Palestinian victims. Could you, and also the issue of the many states talking about human rights in academic context or theoretical context, but when it comes to the issue of Palestinian human rights, they are even attacking students, they're not allowing or attacking people who demonstrate against the war. If you could also touch on that, thank you so much.
Thank you. First of all, I should briefly respond on the second question, sorry, I missed it, regarding resistance. And I think I've said it before, including in this venue, that there is no question that the Palestinians have the right to resist under international law, like all people who are oppressed and who cannot enjoy the right of self-determination. The right to resist is to a people what the right to self-defense is to a state. And in the same way, it has limits. So it cannot, neither can touch civilian life. Civilian life is sacred and should always be protected. So I think that we should always remind ourselves and respect the fact that October 7 has been an unspeakable tragedy for the Israelis who call that event the worst terrorist attack they've ever suffered. And as I've said before, for me those were surely war crimes to the extent they targeted, they hit civilians, and should have been met by justice. This didn't legitimize the attack on the Palestinians, like if they were the nation responsible, because they were not. And again, this should have prompted a reflection on the causes, on the root causes that have led to that horrific day, which is a horrific day both for the Israelis and the Palestinians, I want to underline. Although I think that this is not the day the genocide of the Palestinians in Gaza started. And is it correct that only the Palestinians are denied of this right? No, I don't think so. I think that after after 9/11, there is an increasing intolerance for people's claims for self-determination. And again, we are no longer in the decolonization era, where the right to resist was to an extent even celebrated, to an extent. We are in an era where resistance is often seen and labeled as terrorism. This is the reality for the Palestinians and others. Concerning the suspension, so there are different issues there, but what I refer to is Article 6 of the UN Charter, which says that when a member of the United Nations persistently violates the principles contained in the UN Charter, it might be expelled from the organizations, and there should be a decision of the General Assembly upon recommendation of the Security Council. There have been cases where the impasse of the Security Council has been circumvented by a decision of the General Assembly to act, for example, Uniting for Peace. And this might be one opportunity to consider in this case as well. But I would like to take this opportunity to stress that, again, this is not what prompted me to make that recommendation is not the fact that Israel violates international law full stop. Israel violates international law from its birth, and international law includes UN Security Council resolution and General Assembly resolution Israel has violated, including the UN resolutions that it committed to abide by as a condition to become a member of the General Assembly of the United Nations, and orders and decisions of the International Court of Justice. And again, this year, the escalation of violence and attacks against the United Nations sets a terrible precedent that, if left unpunished, might also encourage other states to resort to the same kind of venomous reactions toward the United Nations, losing all respect for these organizations. And this should not happen. This is why I think it's time to take an exemplar step. Considering why did I mention the lack of empathy? Because I have the fortune or misfortune to always present my reports to the General Assembly after the Commission of Inquiry, which has a team of investigators and so carries out a very thorough work of a collection of evidence. And again, for the third time, I heard the member states criticizing the mandate of the Commission, which means they don't even interact with their counterparts in Geneva, who have toned down their criticism toward the Commission and appreciate the work it does, instead of engaging on the substance. And I've heard member states mentioning again October 7. I understand. I mean, it's not that I criticize that, but like if history started on October 7, forgetting the 56 years of oppression and the tens of thousands, if no more, Palestinians who had been killed, let alone the 1 million people who had been arbitrarily detained, including many children. So it's a bit preposterous. And the fact that 17,000 children have been killed, and this was not even mentioned, together with the full destruction of Gaza, and it made me realize that, no, life is not worth the same, and Palestinian life is less worth. This is for some member states. This is a fact. And I'm also annoyed by the fact that this issue, which is so sensitive to millions, because, again, the life of the Palestinians, first and foremost, but also the life of the Israelis, for many of them, is hell since last year. And there is this sort of let's pick aside attitude in the General Assembly, one side and the other, that, again, it bears testament to the loss of humanity that has penetrated this this institution. The comment I made on human rights and the fact that there has been an erosion of the value of human rights in the last 12 months was prompted by the fact that member states who praise themselves as defenders of human rights and sponsors of human rights, including in their international relations, have not hesitated, have engaged in forms of repression and cracking down fundamental freedoms of their own citizens. And in Europe, including of Jewish people who are standing in solidarity with the Palestinians for what they were going through. And this is very, it's very telling of the bizarre time we live in. But especially when it comes to students who are in a way, the most powerful, but also the most powerful. They've been the most powerful voice speaking truth to power. But also, they're still the most frail part of the society because they are investing a lot in building their future, and many of them have seen their future undermined, sacrificed for standing for justice. And what kind of message are liberal universities in the liberal West sending to the students? Yes, we can teach human rights from our podiums in universities, but then don't dare fighting to have them becoming a reality for all, because this is not your job. Basically, this is the message that is being sent.
About third-party?
Third-party responsibility is... There is a clear obligation, which is a general principle of international law of state responsibility. When there is an international wrongdoing of any sort, violations of international law, human rights law, international humanitarian law, every state has the responsibility not to recognize the legal consequences of the wrongful act, and not to engage, not to aid and assist in the commission of the wrongful act, but rather acting to lead to the cessation of the same and ensure reparations. Nothing of this has been done. But now we are also in a context where, as the International Court of Justice has recognized the plausibility of the genocide could be committed already in January, these triggered the application of the Genocide Convention, meaning the obligation to prevent genocide, for which you don't have to wait to have acts of genocide fully completed and a people or a group completely destroyed. You need to act so that genocide doesn't take place. And so an arms embargo was a clear obligation the day after the court has passed, has issued those provisional measures. Instead, the international community has followed Israel on its attack against UNRWA, and so has continued. I mean, member states continue to trade with Israel and to transfer weapons.
Madam, Mike Wagenheim with I-24 News. It's been a while since we've last spoken. A couple questions for you. In your report, you have a line in here that says that since its establishment, Israel has treated the occupied people as a hated encumbrance and threat to be eradicated. And you go on listing other items. We'll leave aside the contextual and factual debate about that. Based on that statement, it seems to infer that you believe that Israel has been an occupier since the day of its birth. Is that your position? You said since its establishment, Israel has treated occupied people, et cetera. Are you inferring that Israel's been an occupier since 1940?
Why do you have to infer instead of sticking to what I said?
And I'm asking, that's what's in there.
Let me elaborate. Okay. Israel has taken, and I can concede that it has done it with the recognition of the General Assembly, but from a human rights law point of view, and as I take a people-centered approach. I cannot forget it. The creation of the State of Israel has meant the dispossession of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who have been kicked out of their homes and never allowed to return. Why so? And does it make it an occupier? It makes a state, it makes of Israel a state who has forcibly displaced a significant part of the native population. And this is the past that has never been addressed. The Palestinians with Israeli citizenship who remained in Israel have been kept for two decades under military rule. And this is why when I say an encumbrance, I was not even referring to them, but as you ask, I mean, this is documented, so it's not debatable, it's history. And since 1967, which is what I'm most interested in because of the mandate I have, Israel has continued these practices, has extended the custodianship system that had been used to take control of all the properties left behind by the Palestinian refugees, but without time limit. So from 1967, I think this is military order 58, or one of the early military orders, Israel has been able to seize and acquire all the property left behind by the Palestinians. The 350,000 who were forcibly displaced outside the occupied Palestinian territory in 1967, and the hundreds of thousands who have been kicked out of their homes and lands ever since. So there's been a continuity. So it's not just about what has been happening in the occupied Palestinian territory for the past 57 years, is the fact that unfortunately there is a continuity with patterns of conduct that had already been enacted in modern day Israel.
I'm not sure that answers the question, but it will have to suffice. One other question for you, because I know my colleagues want to jump in here. You know about the controversy surrounding your positions and your statements. I'm not going to repeat them here. But you did comment on social media within the past week, and I'm going to read this back. You said, "I'm profoundly committed to human rights for all people. How could I ever be an anti-Semite?" A few days ago, you were supposed to have a briefing with members of Congress. That briefing was canceled. Don't know if the Jewish lobby was behind it or not, but...
Oh, you said Jewish lobby.
Jewish lobby.
Watch out, because it's very anti-Semitic, apparently.
It is. I
didn't use it. You did.
Don't know who you feel was behind it. In any case, you appeared, and your appearance there was sponsored by a group called Code Pink. You appeared in a video with the co-founder of Code Pink. Code Pink, well-documented, shills for some of the world's worst human rights violators. Maduro, Iran, where they appeared with Holocaust deniers. They deny the genocide going on in China of the Uyghur population, completely deny it. How can you say, appearing with a group like that, that you stand and are committed for human rights for all people and are not an anti-Semite? This group is drawn to you, and you happily appear with them while they shill for human rights abusers all over the world and only focus in on Israel.
According to this principle, I shouldn't be asking questions from journalists, for example, unless I check their pedigree. And I explained to you, because I was not at an event hosted by Code Pink. Check your sources, because this is not correct. I was hosted.
You appeared in a video with the co-founder.
Can I finish?
Sure you can.
I was speaking at an event organized by Buzz Boys and Poets, a venue where I've always attended wonderful talks. Then if they have hosted people who have terrible records, I don't know, but I wouldn't feel responsible. And as I was on my way out and looking at the murales, Medea from Code Pink approached me and said, "Can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Of course, do you mind being on record?" Of course not. And that is it. Now, do you want to add on the allegations against me because I answer a question to Medea Benjamin? Or do I have to check, to do a background check on any person I talk to
in order to assuage? You have no idea who Code Pink is? Of course. You had no prior contact with them?
Of course I know who Code Pink is, and apparently I'm not as informed as you are. Thank you for educating me.
That's part of my job as a journalist. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Stefano Vaccara, La Voce New York, Ital Press. I'm sorry because I arrived, I think you had started already a few minutes, so I don't know if you talked about it, but I heard about when you were talking about the Israeli government accusing you to be anti-Semitist, but here of anti-Semitism, but did you respond to that tweet that Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield wrote yesterday? She wrote that as a UN Special Rapporteur Albanese visit New York, I want to reiterate the US believes she is unfit for a role. The United Nations should not tolerate anti-Semitism from a UN-affiliated official hired to promote human rights. This is the ambassador of the United States at the United Nations. What's your response to
I have the same shock that you have looking at how the United States is behaving in this context, in the context of the genocide that is unfolding in Gaza. I'm not surprised that they attack anyone who speaks to the facts that are, frankly, on our watch in Gaza. And they do that so brutally because they feel called out, because it's not that the United States is simply an observer. The United States is being an enabler in what Israel has been doing. So of course they have a conflict of interest in orchestrating attacks against anyone who criticizes Israel. But besides this, I really don't feel comfortable at entertaining any longer discussions concerning the attacks against me, because it's not about me and I'm not the story. The story is the fact that there are Palestinians who risk to be erased from their land. The questions that journalists should ask, I mean, this is what I would expect. How do you comment on the fact that Israel has passed laws that outlaw a UN organization? Because other member states who have even a worse record than Israel could do the same. Human rights record than Israel could do the same. How do I comment the fact that Israel is, there has been a plan to erase Palestinian presence from northern Gaza, and the fact that Israel is freely talking about going back to Gaza and reoccupy Gaza, while the International Court of Justice has recognized that the occupation is illegal and must go unequivocally and totally. This is what I want to talk about, because if we keep on entertaining discussions on is she an anti-Semite or not, I'm sorry. Think what you want of me. I will do my job until I have this mandate, and that is it.
Just a quick follow-up. Just to say that this is about what you have to cover, in the sense you, if I understood you saying basically, don't focus on me, focus on what I denounce in my reports and so on. But if I understand that a special rapporteur is effective or could be effective if it maintains his, if appears, not only his, but appears neutral, or they can, you know, talk to both sides. So for now we're seeing that US ambassador, and it's a personal tweet, I mean, it's a tweet that's attacking you. So my simple question, and it's not a personal question, it's about your work as a rapporteur.
Yeah.
In the last, let's say, 1 year, could you have done something different? Do you think you could have done something different to maintain your, to be more effective in be able to talk to both sides?
But you seem to be someone who measures effectiveness in talking to both sides, and I don't even understand who both sides are. Can you be more specific on who are the both sides?
I'm talking as a journalist. I'm not talking as
I know, but you ask me questions.
As a journalist,
I'd words?
Say that we see if we do a research, you know, we as a journalist have to quote our source and everything. And unfortunately, I say unfortunately, your name now, when you, we quote in our article, because according to the report that Albanese wrote, unfortunately, you are considered, not by me, but by what happened in the situation that we have also that, I don't know, I don't remember Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield do an attack like this for anybody on Twitter. Unfortunately, it's like it doesn't make your work, your reports, what you're denouncing, any more effective.
But this is your opinion. How do you measure effectiveness?
Well,
let's cut it short. First of all, there is an inaccuracy, and I have to be clear about that. And I don't want to put the spot on you, but because I and thank you for that. It gives me the opportunity to clarify. But an independent expert of the United Nations with a human rights monitoring mandate is not requested to be neutral. It's requested to be impartial. It's different. It's different. Tell me how I am partial, because I am the only special rapporteur who has investigated violations of international law committed by Hamas in my second report and the Palestinian Authority. And I've tried to visit the prisons of the run by the Palestinian Authority, and I was prevented from doing so by the by Israel, and who prevented my visit. And if you look at the terms of reference of my resolution, of the resolution creating this mandate, my mandate obliges me to look at the violations committed by Israel. So when you say, talk to both parties, but I understand what you are trying to say. I should maintain a position that allows me to be listened to by all member states. And this is what I've done until March this year. I've had the discussions with everyone. In March, already 30,000 Palestinians had been killed, and it was clear that it was not in the horizon that this would stop. And again, I speak. What do I do? I tell the facts, and I point to the responsibilities of member states. Of course, member states are not pleased with it. So I don't particularly take, I'm not sensitive to the fact that any ambassador criticizes my work. Look at, it seems that there is also some misinformation about the work of Special Rapporteur. I mean, the Special Rapporteur on Iran receives criticism by Iran. The Special Rapporteur on Myanmar receives criticism by Myanmar. What is unique here is that Israel is the only state that is absolutely protected and cocooned by most of the West, what Craig Mohaiber calls the settler colonial bloc. And my mandate is the only one who, in fact, stands looking straight in the face at Western states. So, I take your criticism. Next time, try to be a special rapporteur on the OPT, and maybe you will be more effective than me.
We have a question online. Dawn, if you're still with us.
Sure, thank you, Ms. Albanese. Dawn Clancy with IPS News. I wanted to ask you about one of the recommendations that you make in your report regarding putting some sort of peace force on the ground in Gaza, but I do think you say throughout the occupied Palestinian territory. I wanted to see if you could expand a little bit on what you think that would look like. And then I also wanted to ask you, how would you address the concern that if you put some sort of peace operation, whether it's a force or whatever you want to call it, if you put that on the ground in occupied Palestinian territory, you leave the door, and it's something that's mandated by the UN, it's led by the UN, you leave the door open for some misinterpretation that the UN could be possibly, you know, fighting Israel or squaring up to Israel instead of it, you know, being some sort of peace effort. And I was just wondering how you would respond to that. Thank you.
I think that on this question, we should really consult those who have greater experience than I do with peacekeeping operations, because I'm sure that these are concerns that have been raised in other contexts as well. Israel has no right to be in the occupied Palestinian territory. No right whatsoever. The International Court of Justice has ordered Israel to withdraw unconditionally and totally, as rapidly as possible, its military presence, dismantling the colonies, stopping the seizing the exploitation of natural resources on the occupied Palestinian territory, and making also reparations. Now, how is it going to happen? So the having like what I call protective presence, and they've intentionally been fluid and or ambiguous, if you want, on this one. I've not been very prescriptive, because I don't want the prescriptiveness of my ideas on the one hand infringe on the will of the parties, particularly the Palestinians, because the Palestinians are the one who need to make this request at this stage. There is no say for Israel. But this would also make sure that there is protection for both Palestinians and Israelis while the Israelis withdraw the occupation, so that there is like a buffer. This is as a minimum. But also because there is a urgent need to take the Israeli troops out of Gaza, first and foremost. And in Gaza, the civil order has collapsed because all possible Hamas, the de facto authority-related administration officers have been hit, clan structures, and etc. And so there is a need to have, I think, a transitory force, a transitory presence, which ensures capacity to reestablish law and order, but with a very limited time, because it's time for the Palestinians to determine themselves, but it's going to be very, very hard. The longer the Israeli army remains in Gaza and the rest of the occupied Palestinian territory, the worse is going to be both for the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Can I get one more?
Sure, Dawn, go ahead.
Sorry. I also wanted to ask you about the polio campaign. As I'm sure you know, there's a successful first round of the polio campaign. The second round has been paused because of the fighting or whatever else is happening in the north of Gaza. And I've seen a lot on social media where, you know, entities, especially like COGAT, will say, how can we be committing genocide when we are helping distribute, you know, polio vaccines? We're saving children. And I get that, you know, a vaccine against polio isn't going to vaccine a child against a bomb or a bullet or anything else. I'm just wondering how that fits into the context of genocide, or what would you say to that?
I think that this confirms my sense that there is a general misunderstanding of what genocide is and what genocidal intent is. I've said in my first report that Israel was not necessarily denying to have committed, that the facts I was referring to in the report had occurred, like the bombing and the killing of Palestinians on the ground. It has qualified them differently, and I've said, this is humanitarian camouflage. Israel uses categories of international law like humanitarian zone and collateral damages or human shields to justify and to make an excuse that distract from the intent to destroy. The intent to destroy a people is the determination to reduce the capacity of a group to survive, leading to destruction. And the intent means that having the intent means that you don't even need to have the completion of the design, of the genocidal design, is what you do to the people. And frankly, there has been so much pressure on Israel to allow humanitarian aid. So according to this reasoning, so even the fact that during the starvation campaign that has led many to die and to get sick because of the lack of food, the lack of water, and I've seen some of them, including children. So the fact that every now and then the starvation campaign was interrupted by some trucks allowed in, oh, so Israel is not really starving the Palestinians. I've seen that the vaccination, the polio vaccination campaign, when it started, it was also attacked, it had to be interrupted. How did we get there? Is it a small act of basic humanity going to hide, obscure, and mute what has been done for the past 12 months? I believe it's not. I mean, it might be considered as an exception, but it doesn't change the overall course of Israel's assault on Gaza.
Edith.
Thank you very much, Ms. Albanese, and apologies, I was listening upstairs. A follow-up on what you've just said about getting humanitarian aid in. What is your reaction to the Israeli legislation passed earlier this week that would ban the UN agency that has been a lifeline for aid in Gaza, UNRWA, in 90 days?
Three things. The act in itself is appalling, and it's a blow for the UN Charter and all what multilateralism is premised upon, which is the respect for the United Nations and its programs and agency and organs and officials. This is the second element. It's part of the colonial, what I call the colonial erasure. The fact that Israel, in the pursuit of realizing greater Israel, is attempting to reduce physically or spiritually, meaning as a collective, the presence of the Palestinian identity in the occupied Palestinian territory, which means, I mean, many of whom are refugees. 75%, for example, of the people in Gaza, they're not even from Gaza, they're from modern-day Israel. And therefore, their presence is a continuous reminder for Israel of what I call its original sin, the fact that its creation, doesn't matter the justification behind it. I'm not questioning this from a Jewish people point of view, but the creation of the state of Israel came at a huge price for the Palestinians, and it has never been addressed. And as I said, as after 1967, it has even continued, because in the attempt to expand Israel's control over the land, Palestinians have been increasingly segregated, increasingly repressed. And now, and UNRWA has remained as the symbol of not only of Palestinian capacity to resist on the land, but also Palestinian refugees. And so their claims, their historical claims and their historical demand for justice. This is also part, and it has huge humanitarian implications, because destroying UNRWA, preventing UNRWA from functioning, and UNRWA still is the only remnant of the UN large capacity to still ensure food distribution or aid distribution in general, or medical assistance. Everything is very difficult. I'm not even sure, in fact, that this is the case, because the destruction has been so massive. But still, UNRWA has the know-how to do that. And This is the third element, is that this is nothing new. Israel has been attacking UNRWA for the past 20 years steadily, seeing it as part of the problem, telling the Israel UNRWA was registering Palestinian against the law for refugee status, and I've written widely about that. And then I can tell you, there has been a relentless attack on UNRWA, seen as a symbol of Palestinianness.
And as a quick follow-up, the United States gave Israel 30 days to get a significant amount of humanitarian aid into Gaza several weeks ago. What was your reaction to that?
These are drops. My reaction is that these are drops in the ocean. I don't understand why member states, including the United States, cannot simply follow what the law is. I mean, I'm really worried by the lawlessness that is advanced here. I insist, international law says that Israel, at this point, by the liberation of the decision of the International Court of Justice, Israel must withdraw from the occupied Palestinian territory. There is also a time limit for that. It is September next year. What the question is, what is the United States doing to comply with that decision? What is the United States doing to ensure that Israel complies with the provisional measures of the International Court of Justice? The rest is, again, I think it's smoke in the eyes, I'm afraid.
We have another question online, and then maybe one or two more here, and I think we will have to finish. So, Jordan, online, if
you will. Yes, good afternoon. This is Jordan. Partially you answered my question, but I have to ask the question in different. UNRWA is not only a distributor of food. UNRWA is if you look at DW, is work also. UNRWA is the right of return to the people. What do you think about that? As you mentioned, 75% of the people of Gaza, they are not Gazans. They are, by international law, they are Israelis. They have to go back and become Israeli citizen, but they were unable to return. How can we solve the Palestinian refugees issue with the occupation ending? Because in 1967, Gaza was not occupied, but Israel sent 100,000 refugees to it. In 2005, Israel partially withdrew and then besieged Gaza. But the refugees is there in West Bank. And my other question is, do you think the war in Gaza actually war on refugees and on UNRWA? Because Israel, as many authors wrote, including maybe yourself, is trying to eliminate the presence or the issue of rights of return and refugees. Thank you so much.
As someone who has devoted many years of her life studying Palestinian refugees, including UNRWA, from an academic point of view, a scholarly point of view, I can tell you no. I can tell you no. UNRWA is not the guarantor of the right of return of the Palestinian refugees. That right is enshrined in international law, is solidly built in international law, and even Resolution 194 is not the resolution that creates the right of return. The Resolution 194 is the first durable solution map for Palestinian refugees, for refugees, in fact, because it afforded refugees to choose whether to return to their homes or to resettle. So it's a bit more articulated than that. I do, of course, I agree that UNRWA is not just a provider of humanitarian assistance, but this is also one of the elements of criticism that I've brought to UNRWA, the sense that UNRWA has withdrawn itself in a humanitarian corner in order to avoid political controversies. But the UN mandate toward Palestine refugees is much broader than that, and it also comprises a political dimension that is with another body that was created before UNRWA. It's the UNCCP, the New UN Conciliation Commission for Palestine, and that's been put out of function because, again, of political reasons. Concerning the status of Palestinian refugees, no, under international law, they are not Israelis. Under international law, they are stateless persons. Because under international law, yes, the state of Palestine exists, but is still in captivity. And so cannot ensure the protection bond that is typical of the relation state-citizen. But besides these technicalities, what matters to me is that UNRWA is a subsidiary body of the General Assembly. It's not just a UN agency, whatever, or a UN program. It's been established by the General Assembly, and only the General Assembly can decide the future of UNRWA. And at the same time, I was writing this years ago, during the Trump administration, in fact, when there was the first massive attack from a US administration against UNRWA, and it was probably the first, it was quite unprecedented. And again, this is, it's an assault on multilateralism when member states utilize their power in order to alter the democratic order that exists or should exist at the international level. So the United States or Israel or others should discuss the future of UNRWA within the United Nations and not trying to attack it from outside. Because again, besides UNRWA, and the situation is very serious, I already commented on that, the other problem is that this sets an example to get rid of the United Nations everywhere at any latitude when states, when the states are unhappy with the work of the United Nations.
I'm sorry, I think that's all the time we have because our special reporter does have other commitments. So I thank you all for coming. And with this, the press conference is closed.
Okay, thank you.